Hi, this is JJ, the Practical Alchemist. Here at UK Health Radio, we're hugely saddened by the loss at New Year of my co-presenter, Dr. Mark Goulston. But we hope that you'll appreciate the chance to hear once again one of our Hurt Less, Live More shows in honour of a special friend. Here it is now. Welcome to Hurt Less, Live More with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and Dr. Mark Goulston. This is a show where we just talk openly, maybe have a raw conversation with our guests about all the hurts that people suffer in life and that we've suffered in life and how we get ourselves past them. Now, today we have another fantastic guest, don't we, Mark? It's Margaret Heffernan. And Mark, I'll let you introduce Margaret.
Well, I'm so glad to see her again. She was on my other podcast, and we had a great conversation, as I remember it. Just briefly, and I want to compliment her because she has an enormous bio, and you can find that on Amazon with her 6 books. And she's just—I don't want to say this, Margaret, because it sounds like you sound like I'm about to die. But she's done everything and been everywhere multiple times. But she's not done with the world. So she spent 13 years in broadcasting, 10 years in tech. She's written and published 6 books, written 6 broadcast plays, and she mentors CEOs around the world. And what we were telling her about the show is this is a show to try to lessen people's hurt, because people collectively run away from hurt. They run away into destructive patterns, eating, drinking, being hurtful to others. And we believe that if people could just feel their hurt or feel their fear and communicate that to someone who cares about them, they can prevent themselves from doing something destructive. And that was the birth of Hurt Less. And she's so thoughtful on so many topics. That's why I wanted her to join us. So welcome, Margaret.
Well, Mark, it's really, really lovely to be talking to you again. And it's great to have discovered Health Radio. So thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome, Margaret. And I know that it's going to be a rich conversation today. Mark, I think, though, that you have got probably in your mind, if I know you, you've got a good way of kicking this off today.
Well, before we started, Margaret shared this quote that many of you may have heard, which is, hurt people hurt people. And she and Margaret mentors CEOs all over the world. And I'm guessing that she has run into a lot of them who feel hurt and convert it into something else. The more healthy ones convert it maybe into determination to do something productive for themselves and their people. But the less healthy ones don't do that. So I just wanted to have this conversation, Margaret, and see where it goes.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I think it's certainly the case that people often use work as a way of running away from what has hurt them. I would certainly say I know I've done that in the past. So when I was 30, my first husband died in a very difficult, unexpected accident. And I definitely after that, I just worked like a mad thing, you know, for a couple of years. I think that was actually quite productive. But I think part of what saved me was that after a couple of years, I thought, okay, I feel like myself again now. It's time to start working less. I've definitely seen people who, for whatever reasons, you know, work at work instead of working on themselves, I guess is what I would say. And they play out a lot of the pain and anger that they have experienced outside of work. And that can be incredibly destructive. I can remember working with one individual who I think I had a pretty miserable childhood and escaped it, really, by just becoming a complete workhorse. But the consequence was that he never thought anybody was working unless they worked as much as he did.
Mm-hmm.
And the consequence of that was that he became a bully, really, because nobody could work as hard as he could, because nobody had the drive that he did or the kind of need to work that he did. And the whole thing became very, very unhealthy. And I think he understood this intellectually, but I don't think he had the confidence to change, because this incredible addiction to work, which is what it became, made him very, very successful. It got him out of poverty. It got him a fantastic lifestyle. It got him a huge amount of respect. And I think he never got to a point where he imagined he could have any of those things without working like a demon. And as long as he worked like a demon, everybody around him had to work like demons. And so he created this kind of vortex of overwork, which spun good people away from him, because they didn't have the need that he had. And it was really difficult, because many people really, really hated him, frankly. And I had some sympathy for him, because I could see the hurt in there, but I could never figure out how to make him feel confident enough that if he worked less, he might get more.
I want to share an anecdote and see how either of you relate to this. On my podcast, one of my guests was a fellow named Chip Conley. And Chip Conley owned the top boutique hotel chain, Joie de Vivre Hotels. He sold it, and then he pivoted to Airbnb. And he was one of the principal advisors in that. And when I had him on the show, he said that he was addicted to achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And he reached a point where he had all the financial security, but five of his friends had died by suicide. He had felt depressed and suicidal, and he had more money than he needed. So he pivoted to something called the Modern Elder Academy. And they do retreats in a part of Mexico.
Mm.
But he said, but I'm addicted to achievement. And it was interesting, because as he started talking passionately about the Modern Elder Academy, he picked up speed and he was selling it. I said, Chip, you're still addicted to achievement. You know, and it was a gotcha. And I said, I wonder if you have this thing called the syndrome of disavowed yearning. And he said, what is that? And I said, down deep, we all have a yearning to be whole and at peace, but we don't know how to do it.
Right.
And if when we were young, we had that desire, but it wasn't to be had because of our parents or the environment, we disavowed needing it. We convinced ourselves, I don't need to be whole. I don't need to be at peace. And we pivot. If we pivot to achievement and we get rewarded, you can run with that for 50 years.
Right.
Until you stop running, you know, and he sort of listened to it and said, well, that's interesting. And then it hit him about 3 months later, and he wrote a blog on it for Modern Elder Academy. And he said, you know, maybe what we need to focus on is learning, earning, and yearning. And so I'm sharing that with you. And Margaret, something I'd like to ask you, because I am a psychiatrist, is, after that untimely death of your husband, and you threw yourself into work for a couple mm-hmm. years, did the grief ever catch up to you, or did you just calm down and, you know, and work less?
Yeah. I mean, I think I felt the grief at the time. I don't think that the work displaced the grief, but it didn't take it over. I mean, the work didn't become everything. So I think I was able, with a combination of, you know, really great friends, and some therapy, to kind of deal with everything sort of all at once. But there's no doubt in my mind that the just ferocious amount of work that I did was really just to not feel alone. I mean, it wasn't just that. It was really, really interesting work. And it was work I would have loved doing anyway. But I think the ferocity with which I pursued it, you know, was productive, but it probably would have been as productive, maybe even more so, with less need behind it. But I think somehow, and I can't really explain this, I think I did have a sense that this is a phase and it would be bad if it went on forever, but it's okay for now. And what happened is that after about 4 years, and I produced this gigantic TV series for the BBC, I had accrued a gigantic amount of leave. And I remember saying to my boss, right, well, I'm going to take some leave now and I'm going to come back when I feel like it. And he said, okay, fine. Any idea when that will be? And I said, no, not really, but certainly not for a month. And I came back, I think, after a month or 6 weeks, and came back for a week and said, you know, I still have a lot of leave owing to me and I still don't feel like it. So I went away for another month. And then I thought, okay, now I'm ready to come back and start working in a very different mode, at a different pace, kind of different priorities, and a very different workload. And it was great. And then I reached a point of thinking, I don't want to make TV programs anymore. And then I left. But I think I would always have reached a point of not wanting to do TV programs anymore. Because I thought then, and I think now, I wasn't the world's greatest filmmaker. And I knew people who were, and I thought, well, they should be doing this, not me. And I want to go off and find out what else I might be good at. And I think that's probably the recurring theme in my life, is kind of taking on new challenges as an adventure and a way of exploring both the world and what I'm made of. And all the research that I've done and written about entrepreneurs suggests that that's absolutely typical. You know, people are often right about entrepreneurs being driven by money. This is but never the major motivation. The big motivation is, am I up to it? How can I discover what I'm made of? This is one way. So it is as much a sort of adventure in self as it is an adventure in innovation.
That's so interesting, Margaret. It's so interesting. It reminds me of my father. I see a lot of him in what you're saying, in that he was an entrepreneur laterally. He had his own businesses and he worked long hours. But yes, there was a drive to make money, obviously. But I can also see, in hindsight, that he was actually working hard because he was driven to work hard because he didn't really see any other way of being, and it kept him out of the house, and you know, he didn't have to deal with all the issues at home. And also, you know, recognized that he wasn't a well-liked man in, you know, amongst the people who worked for him.
Yeah.
Particularly, I always remember somebody that I met once saying, oh, you're not his daughter, are you? Never mind. What a shame, you know, who had worked for him. So I can see that, but I can see now that there is a hurt there, right, that was driving this.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he was much maligned by many people. But if only in those days we'd been able to appreciate what brought him to this point, and we mm-hmm. might have been able to make things a bit easier for all concerned. So I right. you know, really recognize what you're saying there. Yeah, from my own experience.
There's a person I'm working with who's been very successful all on his own, but he's not close to his grown children. And he showed me an Instagram of a billionaire who was very rueful. And the billionaire said, the measure of success when you get older is that your grown children want to spend time with you.
Yeah.
And it was clear that his children didn't, this elderly billionaire.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. And it's, you know, often your children don't want to spend time with you because they never did. And it feels too late. I feel quite fortunate that I think I got much closer to my father probably after my 40s, you know, as I got older and he got older. And he became an entrepreneur quite late in life. And so we'd have these long Saturday morning conversations about how's your business going? How's your business going? Well, this is really tough. Well, when I was in that situation, that's what I did. And it was fantastic because it was as if we had, you know, reached a point where we were really talking to each other as peers rather than, you know, father and daughter. And it's interesting for me now because I have kids in their 20s. And I love being with them and they seem to love being with me. And, you know, I think I learn as much from them as they learn from me. And I think we're moving towards that stage where it's not that, you know, it would be wrong to say I'm not their mother. That's always going to be there. But we can talk to each other about things that we care about as equals, which is just brilliant. And it is so much fun. And it's so much fun not nagging about homework and all that kind of nonsense and just having a really interesting conversation with interesting people.
I love that, Margaret, and I'm very envious. Well, let's just hold that thought of how great that relationship might be and just take a break right now. We've got to just hear from our station sponsors for a few minutes, but we'll be back right after this.
The station that makes you feel good.
Delightful news, air travelers. Going in and out of airports without getting sick can be challenging. Time to take charge of the air you breathe with Nasal Guard. Nasal Guard topical gel defends by blocking harmful airborne particles and viruses. Try Nasal Guard for air travelers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More, here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and Dr. Mark Goulston. And we still have with us our guest, Margaret Heffernan, today. And Margaret, something, you know, what you were talking about earlier about the client who was very difficult to work with, and then thinking about my father, actually, it reminded me of a conversation I was having earlier with somebody who's a business coach. And I had this epiphany, and I realized that my relationship with business is very much predicated upon my mother's reaction to my father constantly working at his business, and that constantly being given a negative thrust, a negative connotation. So it was always, oh, he's still, you know, he's late home again. Oh, he's too busy. Oh, you know, he's too busy to take you. He's too busy to take you out somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. It was always this negative. And I've had this real epiphany that actually that has so, it's just been driven so deeply into me that it's actually affected my own relationship with business. And I see myself as pivoting constantly between, yeah, I'm not a business person. Yes, I am a business. No, I'm not. No, I'm not really. To the point where the other day somebody said to me, "And what do you do then? You know, what's your business?" I said, "Oh, nothing very much. Don't really do anything."
Oh, that's so girly.
That is girly. Come on.
I know. But it just came out, right? It was just like, yeah. Oh.
Well, I think this is really interesting because I think when you call it business, it has a certain connotation, which is I'm just doing it for the money.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I have a business which involves writing. If it didn't pay me anything, I'd still do it. You know, I kind of can't help myself. There's a lot of stuff, a huge amount in my working life that I do for free because it's just too interesting not to. So I think it's interesting, you know, this connotation that business has, which is why if people ask me what I talk about, I say that I write about work. I write about decision making. I write about choices. I tend not to say I write about business because I really don't.
Yeah.
This kind of drives my publishers mad because it means I don't fit into a category very neatly, but I don't think the categories fit into life very neatly either, really.
Yeah. And there is this notion as well that sits with me very unhappily that you have to fall into some kind of business model, right? And I've been bucking against that trend for a long while now. So, but, you know, I completely agree with you, Margaret, but it is so fascinating, isn't it, that there is this background of hurt that was allowed to cloud my upbringing, you know, when I was much younger, which has stayed with me all my life.
Yeah.
And of course, then I went into work, which you wouldn't say was a business. I wasn't running a business when I was a journalist, but then, you know, I was a freelance for a long, long time, which is a business, right?
Right.
Always, you know, kind of having that very ambiguous relationship with the notion of business.
Mm-hmm. I think that's worse in the UK, to be honest. Mm. And I think there's a sort of Industrial Revolution mindset where business has this kind of factory feel to it.
Yeah.
That, you know, you're a widget or a product or something, and it's kind of grim satanic mills all over again. I think I've been very lucky, really only ever with a few very short exceptions, to have done work that I just really loved. Mm. And I'm extremely fortunate to be married to a scientist who is a scientist because it's what he really loves. So our children have grown up thinking, well, work is something you do that you love, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, so do I.
But I certainly didn't grow up in that. I mean, very much like it sounds like your background, you know, watching my father's corporate career was watching a hurt person hurt people, for sure. He was miserable and he made people around him miserable. And when he came home, he made us miserable. You know, it was just an absolute chain reaction. And it was only when finally they fired him and he was forced to become an entrepreneur, and so he was his own boss, that he found a way of working that he really loved. And guess what? He was really nice to the people he worked with then, because he was a happy person.
Yes, it's fascinating, isn't it? It is fascinating. But it sounds like you will be, or you have been, giving your children the right start in life, or a good start in life in any case.
Well, you know, you don't, you never know. Right?
Well, I know.
But no, you know, no, so far, fingers crossed, so far so good. But I do think, I really do think it's important not to be too romantic about this, right? You know, only do work you love. But really don't do work you hate, right? I mean, I completely understand. Everybody's got to pay the rent and pay the, you know, grotesque heating bills this kind of stuff. And I have certainly at times in my life had to do jobs I didn't particularly like for that reason. But I didn't think it defined me, and I didn't stay in it any longer than I had to. So I do think, you know, I think there are jobs which aren't terribly romantic or glamorous jobs, but which are deeply fulfilling. And I think the, you know, the mission in life is to find what that is for you. And I think, you know, as we're sitting in the UK and nurses and doctors are going on strike because they're being paid so horribly, I think it behooves us to notice that they've been paid horribly for a really long time. And the reason they keep working is because there is something innate in the work that feeds them. Now, it's not enough to pay the bills with that feeling, exactly. Right? But the reason they stay is because the work has meaning. And I think I'm really kind of horrified by this kind of moment of extreme disillusionment that seems to hit young people at a certain age, where they think, okay, I've had fun. Now I have to find something that will pay my way in life. And the fun's over. I remember I had a student, an MBA student last year, and I was chatting to him and saying, you know, what are you doing this summer? And he said in the most miserable tone you can imagine, I've got to find a job. And I thought, oh, wow, if that's what it feels like, what's it going to be like, you know? And it's like he'd already, before he even started his job search, had given up on the idea that he could find anything that would give him any kind of pleasure.
Yeah, that's very
sad. You know, as I'm listening to the two of you, I'm listening to you through the ears of our listeners, who are mainly women, hardworking women, overwhelmed women, 25 to 45. If you're listening in and you don't fit that, please keep listening. Any thoughts to them? Because as they're listening to the two of you, I'm sure they're thinking, yeah, I have a job, I have to pay the bills, and I haven't felt joy in a long time.
Yeah.
So any thoughts that you can give them so that they don't, I wouldn't say reach a point of quiet desperation, but to have a joyless life is exhausting.
It is exhausting. I mean, I would say a couple of things which are going to seem, I think, a bit antithetical. The first is have very, 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 very low overheads. Right? If you don't have high fixed costs, you have more freedom, and always have your running away money. Always have money where if the job is really crap or the people treat you really badly, you know you can leave. And what I've discovered is there's something magical about running away money, which is this: if you have it, you never need to use it. Because you can negotiate to defend yourself with enough confidence. People just pick up the fact that you're serious. This is not a feint. And so you usually win, right? I mean, I had a point where, one point when I was running my first tech company and it was invested in by a venture capitalist, and I discovered that all the VCs of companies he invested in were being paid twice when I was being paid. This was not a fun moment in my life. And I thought, I mean, I was hurt and I was shocked and I was really angry. And I thought, okay, but Margaret, you've built this company. You've hired every single person here. Are you really prepared to walk away? And I thought, actually, yes, I am, because I can't let this be done to me. So I wrote this very, very, very long email, and then I cut it and cut it and cut it until it was, you know, one sentence, but to the effect of, you know, I'm shocked and dismayed to discover this. And the next day, my pay got doubled. But I wouldn't have written it that simply and boldly if I'd been in a, if I'd felt I had to negotiate. So I think having your running away money, so I knew I could afford to quit. And because I had very low overheads, I think that's a big part of having, feeling you have choices. And the other thing I'd say, because again, you know, because I have kids in my 20s, and I see this a lot, and I see it in a lot of people all over the place. I've met very, very few people who ended up doing what they thought they wanted to do. I've met people who thought that they wanted to be doctors, got their medical training, and discovered they just didn't like patients. I know people who thought they wanted to be lawyers and worked in a legal office and discovered they didn't like lawyers. I know people who've worked in PR and ended up as divorce lawyers. So you have to, you know, you have to try stuff.
Yeah.
And I think there's this weird expectation, you know, from the time that kids can talk, people say, what do you want to be when you grow up? As if you know. And they always ask you when you graduate from university, and you're supposed to make this lifelong decision on the basis of no experience at all. It's mad. So I think the 20s these days are to try stuff and discover what it is you like in work, the kinds of people you like working with, the kinds of activities you like. Do you like big companies or small companies, or you know, where the work is solitary or where it's collaborative, where it's fierce deadlines or it's, you know, pretty mellow. You have to, the only way to find this stuff out is to try it.
And to get started as well, not to prevaricate and say, oh, well, you know, but everything needs to be perfect before I do this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing is ever going to be perfect. You know, so is it good enough?
Yeah.
Or is it good enough for now? Because I'm learning something. If you're not learning anything, then it's probably time to move on.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're, you know, sitting, maybe you're a single parent, or you're a, you know, you've taken time out from work because of kids, and you're just thinking, well, I need to bring in more money, but how do I do that? Well, look at what are you good at? What do you like doing? And is there some way that you can do that as work? But you're right, Margaret, I think. Here in the UK, we have this notion of work as being something that is a drudge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when, you know, very few of us are going down mines these days. Very few, you know, we're not sending kids up chimneys anymore, right?
Right.
But that seems to still be in our heads.
Mm.
And so work can be something that is an expression of you. It can be. I'm not saying that it will be for everybody, but it can be. And you can work at something which you enjoy. It is possible. And I think for a lot of people, when they're looking at maybe what you would call in the States, maybe a side hustle, or, you know, other ways of, they look at those and they think, well, I've got to do this because it'll bring in money if I do that, or I need to follow this program and it'll help me. Not necessarily. Because, you know, it might not be something that fits, that suits you, and it might not suit your way of living. So always look for that thing that's going to work for you rather than against you, as you're saying. Yeah.
And I would say, having employed lots and lots of people, you know, I'd much rather hire people who like what they're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly don't want to be the boss that has an office full of people who hate being there.
Exactly.
And so I don't want to be the sort of boss who feels, well, we have to buy, you know, candies and cakes for everybody to make this tolerable. I mean, there needs to be something in the work that has some kind of meaning to somebody. Otherwise, you really need to review the business plan, I think.
So let me ask you something about the UK, because I'm in America, and I'm in the most impulse-driven part of America, Los Angeles. It sounds like you're saying that that if you were to say that you enjoy your job in the UK, people would look at you that you're strange. It's yeah. almost like this thing. I remember people in Manhattan took pride in saying, "Oh, I'm just so busy. I'm so busy. I can't breathe."
Yeah.
And it's a badge of honor. And so, if you're agreeing with that, Margaret, and you want to hire people who like their job, but they'd be ashamed to say they like anything because they're in the UK. How does that work out?
Well, I think it works out quite poorly. I mean, you're probably not aware, though you might be. You know, Britain has a very significant productivity problem, which is it is less productive than other countries. And as you know, it's really hard to measure productivity and to understand exactly how it's produced, right? But I think that part of Britain's productivity problem is bad management. And another part of it is this negative attitude to work, which assumes it's hateful. And if you run a company where work is hateful, that doesn't matter. That's just goes with the territory. So I think there's quite a low level of expectation on the part of boss and employees alike. And I think that makes some people unproductive.
I think there's a lot of truth in that, Margaret, but let's hold that thought. It's time for us to take another short break right now. We'll be back right after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Start your day the right way with Revive Active's range of super supplements and get the most out of life. Take one power-packed sachet, mix with water, and enjoy a super tasty health drink at work, at home, or on the go. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to optimize your health and well-being to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, and more. No filler, no stimulants, no artificial colors or preservatives. Just the right mix of vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and hero ingredients to help you put back what life takes out. Try our 7-day or 30-day boxes and use code UKRADIO to get a free supplement shaker. Revive Active. Super supplements for a super you.
Nature's Medicine for Modern Living, a people and plants dialogue hosted by Sophie.Health. At Sophie, we bring together experts and voices who rarely cross paths. Our quest is to illuminate the ancient world of plant medicine and reimagine it for the connected age. Join us to explore new boundaries of digital personalized medicine with deep roots in the natural world, and hear from our community of international pioneers who are validating this new paradigm and improving how we feel, sleep, and cope with daily stresses naturally. Sophie.Health, reconnecting people and plants.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More on UK Health Radio and the UK Health Radio podcast with me, JJ, the practical alchemist, and Dr. Mark Goulston, plus a very special guest today, Margaret Heffernan. And we were talking about, before the break, we were talking about the culture of work here in the UK. And it reminded me how recently I was saying to somebody, oh, you know, I've just got a lot of work to do. You know, I'm working. And they came back and said, oh, boring stuff then. And I really took affront. I was affronted. And I said, there is absolutely nothing boring about what I do. And they looked at me as if I was a complete nutter, as if I was mad.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even if you like what you do for work, you don't really say that here in the UK. It's always, oh, boring. Work's boring.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of sort of British trademark miserableism.
Yes.
And it's one of the things I really loved about working in the States is that, you know, although it can often be rather phony and cheesy, you know, people will say, I'm great. I'm having a great time at work. Work is going great. You know, I love what I do, or, you know, I love my coworkers or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they certainly don't. I mean, they may say that more often than is strictly speaking true, but they they will say it when it is true, which
yeah.
I think is the main thing.
Yeah, that's the difference. We will say it's not great when it is, even if it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting because with my mentoring clients, I make it very clear to them that I don't do work I don't like, and I don't work with people that I don't like. And they look kind of astonished, you know, but I want them to appreciate that I am there by choice. I
yes.
don't need the money. I'm there because I think they're genuinely interesting people. And I'm, you know, and I'm willing to spend time with them. And I think that's quite important for them to understand that if I didn't want to spend time with them, I wouldn't.
Yeah, I think that's very important.
No, yeah. I want to run something by you. There's a, and this, and you might say, that is so American, and that is so la-la Los Angeles. So I've been working with companies about how do you improve the culture?
Oh, yeah.
And we came up, now you might say, well, we can see that works in America. It would never fly here in Britain. But what we came up with is if people wake up in the morning, now this may be largely American, if most of your people wake up, and they say, I can't wait to go to work, you have a good culture. You know, if they can put aside their personal divorce, their personal issues and whatever. But when they focus it, if they wake up and most of your people or all of your people say, I can't wait to go to work, you have a good culture. And if they say the opposite, I'm trapped, I'm exhausted, I'm burned out, you have a bad culture. And so the whole approach, which is very simple, is reach out to your people and say, we want you to wake up every morning and say, I can't wait to go to work. So going forward, anonymously, what do we need to do consistently? What positive things do we need to do consistently that we're not doing? And what negative things do we need to eliminate so that you can say that? Because you'll also attract talent. You'll meet with your friends. And if they ask you about our company and you say, I can't wait to go to work, if they don't feel that way, they're going to say, are you hiring?
Yeah.
And it's a very simple approach. You don't have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on these big consulting companies. Just reach out and then report back to them. This is what we're going to eliminate. This is what we're going to do. We're going to check with you every quarter, every month. Let us know how you're doing. And but that it sounds like that would never fly in Britain.
Yeah, I'd love to see that, but you know, have my doubts. But what do you think, Margaret?
Well, I think it would, but I think an awful lot of management claptrap gets in the way.
Mm.
The biggest one of which is surveys. You know, so you have these pulse surveys, or now you have this apparently so-called AI way of keeping track of the mood of the company, you know, and and analyzing words and language and all this kind of stuff. All of which means that managers don't have to have honest conversations with the people who work for them. And I remember I chair an organization based in London, and the CEO was thinking about, as we came out of lockdown, getting people to work and, you know, what did they want to come, what would make them want to come into the office? What did they like coming into the office for? All this sort of thing. And she was proposing to do a survey. And I said, oh, please don't do a survey. Please bring some people together and talk to them. Because if you do a survey, you're going to get some numbers and you're going to think the numbers mean something. It's just you're not going to know what they mean. Anyway, so she did do this and we had small groups of people talking about how they felt about coming back into the office, what they liked, what they didn't like. It turned out, actually, they mostly do like being in the office. They just hate getting there. Right. So they're two, she was conflating two things, which was the commute and the work. And they're actually, one is horrible and the other one turns out quite pleasant. Right. But I think that there's a lot, you know, so work is broken into lots of components, which isn't, all of which isn't really under the control or influence of the company. But in the end, the reason most people stay in jobs is either they like the business is in. You'd have that in healthcare, for example, or they stay for their coworkers. Very occasionally they'll stay because they really like their boss, but generally they'll stay for their coworkers. And so actually what's most important is to make sure that there is some real social cohesion between people. And this sounds to me blindingly obvious, except I'm still being hired to work on this with companies because they think that a really great company is made up of superstars. And what they don't understand is that what makes a really great company are people who really like working with each other. And there's a really beautiful study that came out of MIT about this, which is actually the people who know each other and trust each other are much more productive than people with super high IQs. And that's not because people with high IQs aren't just as sociable as the rest, but it's the mortar, you know, between the bricks that matters more than the bricks themselves. Although all the HR, you know, departments mostly focus on the individuals. It's the kind of collective that the business builds. And that's about the relationship between people. Is there time for it? Do people feel they can make friends at work? Are they too busy to make friends at work? Is it recognized that actually having good relationships with your coworkers is a really great thing? And it's actually part of what makes an organization function. I think most companies focus way too much on the schedule, the timetable, the desks, the lighting, the bagels, the breakfast, the benefits, all, you know, the, is there a yoga room and do we have a good, you know, good healthcare privileges and do we subsidize health club memberships? Actually, if you really like the people that you work with, you'll like being at work.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's an exercise that I've been doing with companies. They say, we want our people to really connect with each other. And the exercise is having people think of a time in their life that they never thought they'd get through, but they did, and pick a time where what helped you get through it was a special person who did something specific. And mm-hmm. when people share this, there's the trifecta of vulnerability, courage, and gratitude. Mm-hmm. So when people are demonstrating vulnerability, I never knew you went through that. Oh, yeah, I didn't know how I was going to get through it. And then when they mention someone, mm-hmm. that's showing gratitude. And right. people are seeing you were so courageous to get through that. And one of the things that we do in the exercise is we say select a incident where someone helped you who's still alive and who you can contact. Mm-hmm. And then the homework assignment during the break is you're going to do a selfie video to that person. And you're saying, hey, we haven't spoken a long time, but we're thinking about people we're grateful to. And what came up is you for me. And this is what you did. And this is how it changed my life. And I hope you're doing well. And what happens is when people are showing that vulnerability, the courage that they got through it, and they're grateful, people bond like crazy in that group.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And what gets you through tough times is always other people.
Yeah, that's so true.
Always. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think these days we're getting out of this this mentality of work being always a drudge. I think there, you know, more and more companies, more and more business leaders I speak to are recognizing the need for, you know, values, recognizing that, you know, good values in a company and living and working towards those. I was listening to somebody giving a talk the other night who espoused just that. And, you know, she loved her business. The people that work there love working there.
Yeah.
But they're very, very clear about the values and relationships, not just with staff, but also with their customers. So, yeah. It seemed like a win-win. And if only more businesses would come from this less hurtful approach, I think we'd do very well and be more productive, as you're saying, Margaret.
Well, they see that in the millennial population. I mean, there's a lot of griping about them from older generations, but it seems like I just read something that they want positive experiences in life. That's what they live for, you know, much more than just the money. And are you seeing any of that in Britain, that millennials, you know, want to break through this drudgery view of work?
Well, I see it a bit. I mean, I'm always extremely wary of generalizing about generations because the people who study this stuff in much greater detail than I do will argue pretty persuasively that the difference between generations is not that great. I think the difference now is that you have a cohort of people in the first half of their 20s whose life experience has been shaped by 9/11, the financial crisis, the pandemic, a war, and climate crisis. And they know, because they're not stupid, they know that probably this is all going to get very, 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 very much worse. That climate crisis will make everything worse. And it isn't going to get fixed on time. And it isn't going to get fixed quickly. And all sorts of terrible things are going to happen to innocent people as a consequence of the fact that my generation and generations after mine didn't do enough about this. That's very, very real to them. And for many, the consequence is, well, I can't buy my way out of this. So making a ton of money isn't going to help me. So I better just have a good time now while I can. And if the job is really horrible, I'm not going to be there. I'd rather take a job that's fun and pays less because money isn't going to be what makes the difference when, you know, when the storms come.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Margaret. I see that myself as well amongst people of that generation. And unfortunately, we're coming to the end of the show. But I'd love to have your thoughts, Mark, on what we've been talking about, because you've been quite silent during this show. You haven't been saying a great deal.
Well, I hope I'm like the listeners of the show, because both of you have just been mesmerizing in your sharing. And I loved what Margaret said about low overhead and walk away money. I thought that was put a bow on that. If you're listening to this, that is such a wonderful orientation to make sure that you don't get yourself into a bind which is going to lead you to feeling powerless and burnt out. But I thought that was just wonderful. And I was feeling so proud to be part of this conversation. So I was just listening and taking pride and being able to call myself your friend.
Oh, that's so lovely. Thanks so much, Mark. And Margaret, thank you very much for joining us today. It really has been. I'm like Mark. I've really enjoyed speaking with you today. I've really loved our conversation. So thank you so much for being our guest today. And yes, to our listeners, do join us again another time for more fabulous conversations on Hurt Less, Live More on UK Health Radio and the UK Health Radio podcast. You'll find us wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts, so do search for us. But for now, from me, from Dr. Mark Goulston and Margaret Heffernan, thank you so, so much for being with us. Goodbye for now.